If I filtered out all the profanities bouncing around in there, I was left with a single clear thought. Eckler isn't right. Really, not right. It's even strange that he decided to surrender the tomb to the Celestial Players without putting up a fight. Considering the amount the corporation had compensated him with, money shouldn't be an issue for him. That means that something else is at play. But what? Attention, everyone! 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 The first Kalragan Interclan Tournament has begun. Everyone to the tournament! During the tournament, killing other players has been disabled across the continent. Furthermore, to ensure that nothing distracts from such a momentous event, during the tournament, access to all dungeons on the continent has been disabled as well. Good luck, and may the strongest among you triumph. Teleportation services to the tournament location are being brought to you free of charge by the Legends of Barleona clan. The next morning was sadly ruinous for my clan. 2 days remained until the tournament, and the entire continent was changing. Festive banners and posters were plastered all over Anhurs. The guards were dressed in their parade uniforms, and even their pikes were festooned with tricolor ribbons, a symbol that during the tournament all wars had stopped around the continent. Three empires, Malabar, Cartus, and Shadow, were united under the eaves of my castle, revealing my coordinates to every thief and brigand in Kalragan. I'm sure that among the tournament participants, there'll be plenty of those who'll plot to rob my castle. After the tournament, I'll have to change my castle's location. Mr. Krestowski will again complain about my spending of sums with 7 zeros. What the hell was I thinking when I offered them all to me anyway? A player dashed past me, handed me a paper, and ran onward. I glanced at the text and couldn't restrain a smile. The corporation had already cooked up a bunch of social quests for the tournament. For example, I had just triumphantly and with great honor received a summary for the 381st tournament with a schedule and list of all its events. Day 1, 1000, tournament opening ceremony. 1400, individual archers competition. Distances of 100, 200, and 500 meters, no level caps. 1500, group activities. Number of participants, 20 to 50, no level caps. 1500, Kalragan's top chef. Qualification phase. 1900, arena. 2 versus 2. Qualification phase. All participants scaled to level 100. All personal items scaled to level 100. 2000, battle of the bards. Qualification phase. Day 2. Day 7. 1000, last man standing, individual competition for the title of tournament hero. 2100, tournament closing ceremony. My eyes almost rolled up into my head when I saw all the events that had been invented for the tournament. Forget two birds. The corporation had decided to kill the entire flock with one stone. There were individual competitions here, as well as contests for duos, groups, chefs, sculptors, bards, and every other gaming class that was committed to crafting. It's scary to even imagine the size of the crowd that'd show up at my castle walls. Please confirm the withdrawal of 30 million gold from your clan account for initial payment for the tournament's opening. With a feeling of utter emptiness, I pushed the accept button and entered my digital signature. Mr. Krestowski didn't have the authority to transfer a sum of this size, so I had to approve it personally. The corporation was getting on my nerves yet again. When someone other than you spends money like this, you tend to take it more calmly. Eckler was about to spend $300 million on this tournament. Well done. I applaud you. Have a pie as a reward, or something. But when you have to give someone $30 million with your own hand, understanding that your return will be insignificant, your inner menagerie, long since in hibernation, will surely start dusting off its torches and pickaxes in preparation of a protest. Animals against financial ruin! All paws to the barricades to oppose corruption and largesse! Down with the tyrant shaman! And other motivational slogans flashed past my eyes when the Klan budget had once again plunged to unacceptable levels. Why is this happening to me?
Look, guys, it's Mayan. Get out of here, you corporate lapdog. Thank you for the tournament.
The other players milling around the Annhurst Central Square had noticed me and immediately began to harass me. The most surprising thing was hearing them berate me. I didn't think I'd given them any reason to be upset. And yet a large part of the players were pouring all their choice words on me, screaming that not only was I the corporation's creature, but that I had abandoned free crafting for easy money. Over the last 3 years, many a hunter of wealth and fortune had studied my biography. Seeing that I had nothing to do in Annhurst, I blinked to Altamita. I wanted to see what had happened to my castle.
"Master!" squealed Viltrius as soon as I appeared. "The hobgoblins wouldn't let him in, so he killed them! The monster!"
I looked around and almost swore. None other than Garanika sat reclined in my throne, sipping some wine from a wine glass. 5 furry spheres lay at his feet. Checking their properties, I discovered that the hobgoblins were still alive. Garanika had wrung them, dried them, emptied them, but kept them alive. Spiteful Noom was muttering grumpily to himself, wandering around the defensive statues he had crafted and glancing unhappily in the Lord of Shadows' direction. The only thing I could make out clearly from his grumbling was,
"I'll get my hands on you yet," and "I'll show you what happens when you hurt my girls."
I guess the statues had attacked Garanika as soon as he appeared, but he simply froze them, as he did to Vemus, whose horn I could see protruding from behind one of the statues.
"Curious boogers," drawled Garanika once he noticed me. "I'll need to get some of my own. I'm surprised I actually had to concentrate so as not to kill them while ensuring that I could speak with you. I wonder where they draw their power from. But all right, that's for later. Get your stuff. I need to introduce you to your future army."
He didn't have to repeat himself. Emptying my personal inventory as much as I could and throwing anything I didn't need into the bank, I left only some diamonds for making the pendants, healing potions, elixirs of mana, 10 scrolls, and then swore at myself one more time for not having gone to see my shaman trainer. Nodding to Garanika that I was ready, I held out my hand to teleport when a surprising exclamation sounded from the front door.
"Halt!" shouted Plinto, bursting into the hall, disabling his acceleration as he went. "Running off to Shadow without me? As man likes to say, like hell! I'm coming with y'all."
Video recording worked perfectly in the castle, And thanks to Stacy's demands and an updated capsule with a memory upgrade, it would turn on any time it could. So now I was imagining how great of a screenshot I could obtain later, and, most importantly, where I would hang it. Guernica, stunned and still, his mouth half open, his eyes foggy, and his imitator trying desperately to resolve the most optimal course of action to take. I have to confess that Plinto had shocked me as well. I hadn't expected this from him, but Guernica shut down entirely. Geez, I sure hope he doesn't, like, reformat himself or something.
"Do you comprehend the consequences of this decision?"
It took the system an entire 30 seconds to generate the appropriate behavioral algorithm.
"A bonus for being one of the first players to visit Armad as a guest and not as a conqueror, the first and only who'll enter and exit the Cellar of Betrayal without having to bash my head against the wall to leave. The first and only, even if just for a short while, shadow vampire. I doubt the Patriarch will object if I do some recon work about how to best fight Shadow within Shadow itself. Do I need to go on? Or are you suggesting that my reputation will drop and all that? Pfft, that don't scare me. I'm going with y'all."
I had to concentrate to understand what this Cellar of Betrayal that Plinto had mentioned was. The player Musubi had set up 100 of the best players from the Heirs of the Titans and the Azure Dragons clans, sealing them in a room inside the city. They were forced to kill each other to get out, but here I ceased to understand the point of going to that room. There wasn't anything there, after all. Why would Plinto need this?
"I accept your choice, right, Reverend Plinto the Bloodied," Guernica uttered in an official tone and even bowed to the rogue noticeably. "You are not bound to me by anything, so you shall have a reward once the tournament is over. Whether you accept it or not shall remain up to you. Do you need time to get ready?"
Plinto smirked and shook his head, while I looked at the vampire with entirely new eyes, following Guernica's words. When had he gone from a cleric to a reverend? Attaining a new rank, as I well know, isn't a matter of scratching your head. You have to put in an effort. Does he live in Barleona, or what? Guernica told Viltrius to soak the hobgoblins in water to restore them, then appeared beside Plinto, touched him, appeared beside me, and the world around us lost its volume, transforming into the special effects of the inside of a portal.
"Welcome to Armad," Guernica said triumphantly, when reality regained its substance.
I barely managed to look up to see how the palace had changed since the cataclysm, when a long litany of notifications began to stream past my eyes with the speed of a bullet train.
"Achievement unlocked. Too good to be true. Description: you have joined the first 50 players who have visited all 3 palaces of the 3 empires. +2 attractiveness with all Kalragan NPCs. Quest available: secret recon. Quest available: a friend among strangers. Quest available: Matahari, Ames, Fuchs, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, you. Quest available."
The system offered me a dozen quests for various factions and empires of the continent, beginning with a basic reconnaissance and mapping of Armad, and ending with a quest to assassinate Guernica. The reward for each quest was so attractive that everything contracted inside myself when I pushed the decline button again and again. My reputation with the various factions, even ones I'd never come across before, plummeted. But I couldn't care less. I didn't come here to spy. When the quests ceased appearing, or perhaps when the system decided that I wasn't about to take its bait, the flickering before my eyes ceased. I was about to look around and enjoy the work the developers had put into the continent's third palace when Garanika suddenly said to me, "Check them." For about 10 seconds, nothing happened, and I even managed to exchange puzzled glances with Plinto when a painfully familiar voice sounded from behind me. "They're clean, brother. Neither Malabar nor Cartus sent them to us."
"Your reputation with Garanika has grown. Current status, respect. You have gained access to the Palace of Shadow. Current access level, 38%. Your reputation with the factions of Malabar and Cartus has fallen to friendly status. You have lost access to the Palace of Malabar. You have lost access to the Palace of Cartus. You have lost."
A dozen notifications popped up informing me of all the locations I had lost access to. But my full attention was concentrated on one tall person dressed as a high shaman. The red cape, the hat with horns, the staff, and a mallet and tambourine hanging from his belt. Shyam's dark hazel, almost black eyes, were drilling into me like he wanted to incinerate me where I stood. I doubt there was an NPC in this game who hated me more than Shyam, and I doubt there's an NPC in this game that I'd be happier to dispatch for a good long rest. The corporation had managed to concoct a program that I really disliked. And that was putting it mildly.
"Cheepers!" grinned Plinto,
deciding that the silence had drawn out for long enough.
"You two are staring at each other like a husband and wife who've been at it for a decade." "Theirs is a complicated relationship,"
Garanika chimed in glibly, then turned to his brother and, in an utterly different voice, one that radiated might and the impossibility of disobedience, uttered,
"I forbid you from hurting Mayen or Plinto for the next 10 days. He shall represent Shadow at the tournament. Are there any questions?"
Shyam's face twisted itself.
"I have no questions, brother,"
he all but spat out, turned on his heels, and quickly walked out of the hall.
"My, how serious everything is here,"
Plinto went on mocking.
"Searches and orders and prohibitions and questions. What was all that?"
Garanika decided that Plinto's question was a rhetorical one and didn't bother to answer him. Instead, a portal flared to life, dissolving the space all around it. Garanika had made sure that we were serious in our intentions, and was now prepared to lead us onward. By the way, so it turns out that Plinto also refused the unbelievable bonuses for establishing a spy network in Armard. I will have to ask him why.
"What the hell?"
Plinto blurted out when the game returned to its prior density. Garanika didn't bother to take us around the various parts of his palace to show off its wonders. The imitator was playing the part of the head of an enormous empire who didn't have time to spare whatsoever.
"Your first warrior,"
Garanika said curtly, impassively staring at a player running through an obstacle course, in the form of an enormous cat shrouded in tattered fog. No, not a cat, but a puma. A druid? I tried to check the properties, but couldn't catch the puma in focus, as there were constant pendulums, axes, and blades flashing between us. I shared Plinto's shock entirely. The rogue's obstacle course in Anhur's, which I had once traversed 100 meters of, was a playground for children no older than 2, in comparison to the monster we were looking at. I blinked and tried to get used to the rhythm of the pendulums when a shiver ran down my spine. Their movement was not subject to the physics engine. They moved so chaotically that a reasonable question occurred. How is the puma still running that course?
All right. I'll give it a shot. Doesn't do to leave the girl on her own.
Plinto transformed in a flash. The chain mail vanished, revealing a taut leather armor, or cloth armor. It was difficult to tell what Plinto had donned, but one thing was clear. The rogue had ensured he would have a full range of motion. Even his feet were now shod in moccasins instead of his customary combat boots. Looking at the vampire's gaunt torso, the only thing that popped into my head was a fly. He was basically a weightless gymnast, capable of performing miracles at athletic competitions.
And Seneca, meet Mayen. He will lead the Shadow Raid at the tournament, said Garanika,
offering his hand to the elf who had managed to encounter a sharp pendulum blade after all. I smirked. An elf druid? And she's playing for Shadow? Whimsical combination. Not only are there too few elves in the game, but they're also playing for Garanika.
What's up? I'm Anna.
The girl smiled blindingly and offered me her hand. I shook it with pleasure, earnestly examining her. A pleasant, pretty face that was a little scary and fitted with incredibly deep, saturated gray-green eyes which seeped fog, and cute little elf ears living a life of their own. I realized that everyone tries their best to look like they're in a fairy tale in this game, but even in this context, Anna could easily be considered one of the prettiest girls I had ever seen. Forget that. She was the 4th prettiest. Anastaria, Raniata, that mage chick who was always bickering with Stacy, whose name I no longer remember, and now Aunt Seneca. I sure am lucky with pretty women.
Tell him about your abilities, commanded Garanika. Don't forget to mention your lunar bind. A part of your trials will be this evening.
Okay. So, where should I begin? Well, in general, Tam...
Anna began to stammer and vacillate.
Sorry. I'm nervous. It's the first time I'm speaking to such a famous player. I'm afraid I'll say something stupid. Stop. What's got into me? Oh, that's right, my abilities.
Having a conversation with Aunt Seneca was quite the pleasure. She was a mad blend of competence, childishness, and carelessness, all diluted with happiness and sincerity. Clearly, with substance and examples, but at the same time so whimsically that a smile appeared on my face, she began to recount all her abilities. Plinto, who had failed out of the obstacle course in the meanwhile, without having even reached the spot where we had first seen the puma, joined our conversation and began to ask all kinds of technical questions. The time it took her to cast her spells, how long they affected the enemy, taking into account shadow alignment, character properties, and development specifics. Naturally, a great portion of these questions were quite private in nature, and yet the level 155 druid answered everything we asked her. The day went by in a flash. Even though officially Shadow wasn't an empire that players could play for, there were plenty who did so anyway. Guernica introduced us to 25 who were, in his words, the most notable of the free citizens in his empire. I was particularly pleased to meet a paladin-mage couple, a guy and a girl who decided to switch sides to Shadow with their entire clan of two. On the other hand, now, joked Shadow Paladin Endiga Mizradin, the Silver Moon clan enjoyed the same status that Phoenix had in Malabar and the Dark Legion in Cartus, the number one clan of its empire, even if unofficially. To my astonished question of how a Shadow Paladin was even possible, Endiga explained that Iluna remained his goddess. She still hoped that he would return to the one true path, and therefore hadn't stripped him of his powers. Along with Guernica's gifted shadows, the paladin's powers were such a mishmash of entries that I got lost in his description after a few minutes. One thing was clear. We had a level 247 tank and a level 212 shadow fire mage named Eerie. The girlfriend, or wife, I never did figure out what their status was, provided fire support under the principle of, even if the entire world is against you, I'll stand beside you and feed you ammo. One provides the cover, the other pours burning shadows on the enemy. A volatile mixture.
"Finally, the last member of our team," said Guernica, teleporting us to
a library.
I'd gotten accustomed to not being surprised by anything in this game, but the creature that now appeared before us forced me to relive that forgotten feeling. Scorning all rules of decorum, I opened the properties of the girl, who was too engrossed in a book to notice us, to see who I was even looking at. A profaned biota. The system immediately offered I familiarize myself with this new race, projecting the image of a typical biota. But I swiped all that away. Not right now. Although, if the typical specimen is what a biota is supposed to look like, then Lorelei, as this player was named, looked quite atypical to her fellow biotas. And not necessarily in a good way. But, well, different. Through her bluish-green skin, which resembled more that of a pickle than of a human, small and sharp thorns protruded, sometimes forming ornaments and sometimes simply chaotically. The black veins along her skin indicated that some disease was rapidly spreading through this creature's circulatory system. And altogether, this looked both visually interesting and revolting. When Lorelei looked up from her book and over in our direction, I had to make a great effort not to start back. Her eyes were perfectly green, without even a hint of whiteness, an iris, or a pupil. It was impossible to tell where the girl was looking, which stressed me out. I'd never considered the fact that I'd grown accustomed to looking at the direction that the person I was talking to or arguing with was looking in. I was accustomed to seeing the eyes of any sentient creature of our world. Not for nothing, the devs had endowed even the lowliest mobs with pupils, figuring accurately that players might be shocked by their absence. I suppose when it came to the biotas, they had decided to try something else. I suppose I'd jumped the gun boasting about my luck with women. By the way, it's strange that girls typically create attractive avatars for themselves. But in this case...
Hello, I said the first thing that came into my head. What are you reading?
As usual, man is verbose and eloquent. Plinto jibed, turning to the girl. I'm Plinto. This is Man. Let's assume we've been introduced. We're assembling a team here, and we need a list of your powers.
What?
You're not going to make some joke about salad, broccoli, a cactus, or cipollino?
The girl asked in a mocking voice, sliding the book aside. Cipo what? I frowned, unsure of what the girl was getting at. From a technical perspective, the biota really could be compared to a cabbage due to the various leaves that covered her. But associating this creature full of shadow and shades with a lowly cabbage, I don't know about you, but my brain is incapable of such abstractions.
Forget it. You weren't even born when children were watching that movie. Darling, tell me. Why are you here, and not at the obstacle course? At your level 143, it'd do you good to use the grinding opportunities of the local facilities as much as you can.
I am increasing my skills, Sergeant.
Lorelei barked unexpectedly, and erupted with joyful, infectious laughter.
Oh, really? You served?
Plinto's brows rose higher.
Something like that. One day with Polly and Xander is worth a year's worth of service.
Her reply didn't clarify anything for me.
I see.
Plinto smiled, while his face acquired a rare gentleness.
You live with soldiers?
What do you mean, live? I survive with them.
Lorelei corrected him with businesslike irritation. Here I had to admit to myself that I had completely lost the thread of their exchange, ceasing to understand them just a little more than at all.
Listen, my head's hurting from this chatter, so let's just get to your powers, I asked Lorelei.
By the way, how do I pronounce your name? Is it Lorelei or Lorelei? Maybe Lorelei.
The stress falls on the last syllable, so Lorelei. But you can simply call me Lori. As for my powers, you can look through them yourself. It'd take too long to list them.
Lori didn't waste much time and simply granted us access to her character's properties. In everyday reality terms, the girl had just appeared before us in less than her underwear. She was completely nude. And she'd even handed us an X-ray for the sake of thoroughness. Either I'm missing something, or the people playing for Guernica are strangely naive. No one had said a single word about us digging around the properties or attributes of the players we'd met. Trying not to look at the items that Lori currently had equipped, half of which would drop if she died, I made a copy of her current stats, opened her spellbook, and got down to reading.
Shadow Shield. You allow a piece of the surrounding world to enter you and summon a shadow to defend yourself. The shadows surround the bard, absorbing the damage he is taking. Damage absorbed by each shadow, intellect times 10. After absorbing its maximum level of damage, the shadow vanishes. If an undamaged shadow receives damage in excess of its maximum absorption level, excess damage is channeled into the interior world. Maximum number of shadow shields, 1 plus composition. Basic time of use, 5 seconds. Cost, character level times 10 mana.
I read over the bard's defensive ability several times, until I understood that I was looking at a different version of the Paladin's bubble. Considering that the biota race was intrinsically inclined to intellect, her shield would be able to absorb a lot of damage. Of course, Plinto, in sprint, could deal 10 blows in several seconds, yet Plinto was one of a kind, while there should be many biota bards.
This ability has nothing to do with the biota race.
Lorelei explained to my comment that with a spell like this, a bard is practically a paladin with a ukulele.
And it doesn't do to call Eid a ukulele. He won't like that.
He?
You can see for yourself,
grinned Lori, and pulled the strangest guitar I'd seen in my life out of her bag. In any case, it looked like a guitar to me. The 12-stringed vegetable thing resembled its owner in a way. Clearly, it had been acquired in some biota location. But I really was in for a shock when Lorelei began to play it. I never imagined I'd hear an electric guitar in Barleona. The figure of a brawny warrior appeared next to the bard, decked out in plate armor from head to toe.
"And why do we always find ourselves in some strange location?"
the knight asked in a low, ample voice.
"And among strange company,"
he added, looking at Plinto and me.
"Let me introduce you,"
Lorelei replied.
"This is Mayen and Plinto. They will lead the raid at the tournament we are participating in. And this is Eid, the spirit of my instrument, and, at the same time, a tank."
The ghost knight bowed his head respectfully, but didn't offer his hand. I wonder if I could even touch him.
"Hey there, Iron Man."
Utterly unfazed by Eid's transparent state, Plinto slapped him on the shoulder.
"What great blood flows, used to flow in your veins?"
"I don't believe that the word blood applies to me. I was never like you. I am the soul of this instrument, created by a great luthier,"
Eid informed us, and in one fluid motion flowed over to Lorelei's right shoulder.
"All right, don't stress it,"
Plinto turned to Lorelei.
"How long can you summon him for? And how does he tank? How does he heal? How does he..."
The questions and answers began to pour forth like a rushing river, and I quickly got lost among its eddies and tributaries. Raid leaders who know how to manage the player's best attributes are either born or formed through constant practice. I'm ashamed to admit it, but for me, this role was inaccessible. In any event, at the moment, it'd be a waste not to learn how to lead a raid with such renowned teachers as Anastaria and Plinto.
"Listen, if it's not too much to ask, maybe you'll play something?"
After Lorelei had answered all his questions, Plinto stayed quiet for about 10 seconds, calculating something in his head, and then decided to say what was on his mind. It had really been a difficult day. Of the 26 meetings we had, I could recall about 4 of the powers that had been shown to me. It's a good thing there's a video recording of the whole thing, and Stacy would help me figure everything out later.
"First time I've seen an electric guitar in Barleona. I'd love to hear it."
"No question about it."
Lori thought a few seconds, and then strummed the strings.
"I'll show you why Guernica granted me the power that you mistook for a bubble, and you'll get to see how I can buff other shadow creatures around me."
It turned out that Eid was a copy of a guitar synth from reality. At least, that was how Plinto described this miracle. The product of an advanced technology that combined the functions of a guitar and synthesizer, which allowed musicians to imitate the sounds of basically any string instrument. Even though this was far from my wheelhouse, when they told me that the guitar synth could be programmed with basically any sound, I began to realize what was going on. Sarcastically, I inquired how it could even be possible to program a string instrument with, for example, a flute or a drum. An organ? I didn't really have that many words in my vocabulary for musical instruments, but I did have enough to ask this quite pithy question, and I received a very pithy response. It wasn't possible. You could only partially add separate effects and plugins of other instruments into the traditional game.
This was precisely why guitar synths hadn't supplanted traditional synthesizers, while at the same time unlocking very interesting possibilities for guitarists. Lorelei interwove an organ line into the guitar's melody, and the library filled with a deep music full of power and latent menace. When Lori's voice joined Eid's, I shut my eyes in pleasure and submerged myself in the music. Reinforced with spells, the bard's voice literally forced the air to vibrate. Shivers ran up and down my body in packs, and a pleasant sensation began to unfold itself in my chest, as if a small sun was being born there and trying to fill me with its strength and energy. I wanted to run, fly, and swim at the same time. The feeling was incommunicable. I'd never felt such an energy and desire to do something. My hands were literally shaking from my impatience to grab a shovel and start digging from the fence and until lunch. Amazing. Lori wasn't simply a genius. She was stunning. And the song... what song? This was a hymn. A real, genuine hymn. To Shadow. The sound and the song ended abruptly. I opened my eyes and shut them, for there was nothing around me, aside from a strange, dark, and swirling fog seeping from my own hands. Sighing deeply and dispelling my desire to fly, I opened my eyes again. The fog became transparent. Lori and Eid, who was covering her with his shield, were slowly retreating from the boiling and bubbling brick on the library's floor. The desk that Lori had been reading at was half gone. The shadows had consumed it. They were rushing through me, trying to burst forth and destroy the surrounding world, and, at the same time, I couldn't do anything to stop them. I didn't want this. All of me wanted nothing but to plunge everything into chaos. Suddenly, a wild and piercing shriek sounded, rising in pitch to ultrasound. The shadows whirling around me shuddered, as if they were alive, and darted to the right. I followed their motion and saw a similar moil of shadows beside me. Plinto also wanted to destroy the world. Our shadows touched, and, to my surprise, began to consume each other, or destroy each other. This is why the Hymn of Shadow shouldn't affect the free citizens, said Guernica's sad voice. The power, the strength, and the desire to become mighty and deadly all comes with an Achilles' heel. For some reason, when the shadows come into contact, they begin to destroy each other. Lorelei, you must flesh out your song. Free citizens should not be subject to the hymn's power.
It'd be nice to know what I'm supposed to do with this, too,
Lori muttered quietly as Plinto's whimpering sigh filled the library.
I'll be gobsmacked.
The rogue had really taken a hefty blow. His eyes were wide open, their pupils immense, clearly indicating that I had been lucky that my sensory filter was still all the way up. The only thing I had felt were vibrations and emotions. Plinto, it seemed, had felt much more.
"Don't you play with the Heralds of the Horn Band?" he went on, rubbing his temples wearily. "After that, yes, it's hard to recognize you. Damn, that was pretty cool. Like that one time in the cave with the Sounds of Barleona."
"What sounds?"
Lori inquired, peeking out from the shield of the spirit escorting her.
"I'll dig up the recording and send it to you. I won't leave you alone now, my little cabbage. I'll bring some fans, too. My wife won't forgive me if I don't tell her that I met none other than Kira White herself.
Still struggling to come back to his senses, Plinto took on his vampire's battle form. Two enormous black wings unfurled themselves behind his back. His eyes turned red like an aggroing mob, and auras of fear and panic appeared around him. To complete the transformation, sharp fangs extended from his upper lip. There aren't many players who could calmly look on this extravagant rogue, and Laurie backpedaled instinctively, instantly butted up against Eid, and cursed loudly.
"Keep in mind, bloodsucker, that besides cabbage, my ancestry includes garlic, too,"
she warned, just in case, without hurrying to step out from behind Eid, who was covering her.
"Hey, I'll keep that in mind. Man, transform into a dragon. You'll feel better,"
Plinto said, turning back into his human form and stretching his neck.
"You should be aware, madam, that I don't eat ladies. Not for dinner, in any case. Better tell me, what's the next song? We play your masterpiece about the fifth horseman all day long in our house. I never imagined that I'd like a rock ballad, but you really are something. Can I get your autograph?"
"You should have seen yourself a minute ago."
Lorelei still looked a little taken aback and uncertain, but she risked stepping out from behind Eid.
"Who could say no to someone as scary as you? Anyone who dared would probably find themselves in the Greylands in the blink of an eye. As for new songs, you'll hear them at the Battle of the Bards. We almost have a new album ready. We were thinking of using the clan competitions to do some marketing for it. But then this tournament popped up, and I guess we'll have to play some of the new songs at it."
"You lot are getting too distracted," Guernica intervened. "There's a tournament ahead of you, and you need to get down to business. If you've settled the matter of Lorelei's powers, you should leave her so she can work."
"Easy for you to say. Work,"
Laurie grumbled quietly, sitting down in the surviving chair. The armored ghost immediately took up his customary position on her left shoulder. The bard inhaled deeply, exhaled, and looked up at Guernica with her strange eyes.
"You can't simply up and write a song about a person you know nothing about, aside from some contradictory myths. And this library has neither a catalog nor an index nor some alphabetical organization system. The little I've managed to glean about Commandant over the last day won't be enough for even half of a chorus. Once upon a time, there was a great hunter who united the human tribe into a single empire. And that's it. No details. I can't work like this. I can't even pin down a contemporary of his to speak to. I could summon its soul and find out at least something about Commandant that way. He may be the most famous historical figure in the Barleona lore, but there's absolutely zero info about him."
"Commandant?"
"What do you need Commandant for?" I asked carefully. "Maybe Plinto is right, and I should turn into a dragon to release this pressure that's throbbing all through me. I wonder what'll happen. Will I become a dragon of shadow? Or simply a normal dragon that seeps fog?"
"You're right to point out that I'm not the first to use shadows. Commandant used them a long time before me, so I wish to summon his spirit and ask him how he learned to do it. The bard must find or compose a song that will summon this creature."
"That's a little more accurate." I became so interested that I even calmed down a little. "What do you mean by summon a spirit?" Lorelei sighed and told me an entertaining tale about another ability of the bard, which was not directly tied with her combat abilities, the ability to summon the spirits of dead creatures. The important thing here was to show the system that you're summoning a specific individual, and for that, you needed information about them. The more you specified the dead individual, the higher the probability of summoning the soul you needed. The bard had another, more complicated way to do this, by personally traveling to the Greylands, but even there, she would need detailed information about the soul she wanted to summon.
"Man, don't you think that it makes sense to share some information with her?"
Plinto wrote in the clan chat. The rogue looked at me inquisitively, but didn't say anything out loud, allowing me to make the decision on my own. "There's too little information about Carmondont in the books," I agreed with Plinto. I tried to find some mention of him in the Anhur's library, among the jewelers. I even asked the Emperor, if I'm not mistaken. But what's out there, in public sources, doesn't really correspond to who Carmondont was in real life. I don't know if it'll help you compose your song, but listen to this. Here is what really happened with Carmondont, the first human emperor. I told Lori everything I knew, how the hunter started out, who he was, who he became, what he created, and what he eventually did. I'll be the first to admit that the story that ensued wasn't the nicest, but it was the most complete and accurate story of the ones that currently existed. Lorelei stayed quiet for a while, considering what she had heard.
"Again with those overgrown spiders," she muttered to herself. "I suppose I might manage summoning this soul out in the Greylands. There's already one song that seems relevant, and there's even a specialist on the tarantulas and their followers. If I don't find Carmondont, I'll find one of his fellows."
"You know something about the tarantulas?" I asked, surprised. "Will you share?"
"I can even sing a song to you about them," she promised. "But first, let me do what I promised Guernica."
"In that case," Guernica decided, "Plinto, there's no limitation on killing another free citizen in my empire. So, if you would be so kind, please take care of this fine lady. Kill her."
Chapter 10 The Chess Set of Carmondont. I was sitting alone at a recently repaired table in the Armard Library, trying to understand something from what I was reading. The book was interesting, and it had pictures. The letters were all familiar to me. The words that the letters composed were also well known to me. Even the sentences carried their meaning, and yet the idea in the text kept evading me. The sentences I read didn't linger in my mind for longer than a second. Each new sentence was completely new and entirely unrelated to what had come before. It was unique, and trying to escape my mind like the dozens or even hundreds that had come before it. Reading was the last thing I wanted to be doing. The shadow hymn required immediate action and emotional expression. As soon as Plinto had sent Lori to the Greylands, Guernica spirited him away to training, promising to show him something that would even surprise the world-weary rogue. Plinto could not refuse an offer like that. Before leaving me, he repeated his suggestion that I turn into a dragon to dispel the buff I'd been saddled with. But I was overfilled. I needed to transfer the effects of the hymn on my own, without resorting to any damn dragons. Tossing the book aside, I sighed deeply and paced the room, barely keeping myself from breaking into a run. I wanted to do everything at once. Jump,
Fly, jog, swim. No, this wouldn't do. If I can't occupy my mind, I'll break down. Where's my design mode? Tossing aside the illuminated version of my crafting interface, which kept dutifully appearing by default, I sighed with relief. The effects of the shadow him in design mode were noticeably weaker. My eyes began to wander along the virtual shelves. No, it really is easier to be here. I don't even want to. The orc warriors from the Carmadon chess set drew my attention. Powerful, regal, indefatigable, the eight figurines represented unique items which no one would manage to recreate in Barleona ever again. Even me. Orcs, dwarves, ogres, giants, late, the lizards. Six types of pieces I'd crafted facing six more that had not yet been crafted. The war horses, the trolls, the elves, the orc shaman, the archmage, the leader of the White Wolves clan. Although, no. There was also the chess board that had to be crafted. So all in all, I've crafted less than what I haven't crafted yet. In other words, I had barely begun to complete the mission of recreating the chess set. Should I drop everything and give up? Forget about the complete set? Admit that it would never be recreated after all? Like hell! My desire to act consumed me entirely. Shall I jump and jog? Shall I fly and crawl? Not in this life. I know of more productive ways to blow off steam. The knights, or rather the two amethyst war horses, no doubt these are powerful monsters clad in armor, who had performed some great feat in the course of their difficult lives as animals of war. Perhaps they carried a king or emperor from the field of battle, and did so on their last legs. The design mode immediately began to waver, offering to show its customary video series about the knight's history, but I forced it to regain its customary solidity through an unbelievable exertion of will. No! Enough tales! Enough distractions! My head began to heat up, and I got the distinct impression that blood, non-existent in Barleona, was trickling from my nose, but I refused to surrender. I saw the projections of two massive horses rearing on their hind legs and thereby using their chests to shield the riders on their backs, a goblin and a biota. An odd combination for Malabar. Design mode wavered again, offering me the chance to watch this story, but I shook my head, dispelling the offer. No! The Emerald Troll Archers. What might they be like? Grand and mighty? Like hell. They're trolls, after all. No doubt, they're two loners who like to lie in ambush and await the moments when no one expects them. Or expects them, but from the wrong direction. They're trolls. Sarcastic, wry, smirking, with long recurved bows and black arrows. Why black? I have no idea. More vivid that way. I'm not sure why, but at this point the name Edka popped into my head. Odd. As far as I recall it, it was that of a shaman. But, okay, I hereby name one of the trolls Edka, and the other? The system came to my aid here, as through the confines of the wavering design mode I heard,
"Enough, Taney! You've already won! Taney, stop!"
I made another effort, the taste of salt appearing in my mouth, but design mode again regained its solidity. I don't want to watch cartoons. The other troll will be Taney, then. Why not?
Should there only be men on the board? Women, especially troll women, were a terrifying power. Just look at Stacy. And two sharp-eared and hunching trolls appeared beside the rearing war horses. Excellent.